Welcome back, friends. Welcome back. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're watching the AP Perspective, Asia-Pacific Perspective, that is, that monthly series where we take a look at all of the latest news that's coming across the headlines here in the Asia-Pacific region with our good friend and co-host, Brock West of APPerspective.net. But, of course, this is you'll be forgiven if you've forgotten about this series entirely. It's been more than a couple months since our last edition, just because of scheduling problems. So it is good to have you here again, Brock, but of course the problem with that big lengthy delay means we have a ton of information to get through. So I think we're going to have to take a deep breath and just roll up our sleeves and get at it.
I think so. Once again, thanks for having me back on. It's been, as you said, quite a lengthy enforced hiatus, unfortunately, both of us suffering computer malfunctions and various scheduling issues and life getting in the way, as it tends to happen from time to time. But very, very happy to be back. And yeah, I mean, wow, we've got so much to get through this week, James. A lot of important developments that have been continually happening while the world has been preoccupied elsewhere, particularly in the Middle East, obviously. So let's get right into it. Hey, our first story is based here in Australia. So as you and James Evan Pilato recently pointed out on the most recent episode of New World Next Week, the mainstream media and the political hysteria surrounding nationals and citizens going off to Syria and Iraq to fight for the Islamic State has been hyped well and truly over and over again for weeks and weeks now. And here in Australia, it's absolutely no different. While we collectively hold our breath to see if the coalition is going to yet again commit more troops into another unwinnable, destructive quagmire of a war. However, in the meantime, the Australian government has been also revived the idea of full-scale data retention schemes, you know, of course, to stop the terrorists, James. So this one coming from rnif.com. Quote, the Australian government announced new anti-terrorism measures this week in response to the alleged involvement of Australian citizens with extremist groups in countries including Syria and Iraq. However, quietly omitted from the briefing at which those changes were announced, but separately leaked to the press this week, were the government's plans to introduce mandatory data retention requirements for all Australian ISPs. These changes are causing an outcry from privacy advocates and political parties alike, as they should. The new measures remain shrouded in confusion, some of which coming from its very proponents. There have been conflicting reports about whether users' browser history would be hoovered up by the new surveillance laws. The government has attempted to clarify, emphasising the data retained would at least include the IP address of websites visited, as well as the times and durations of visits. However, also included would be the senders and recipients' email addresses, IP addresses assigned to the users, as well as details of phone calls such as caller and recipient numbers, caller location and duration. So, James, one of the main proponents of this nationwide surveillance operation is Australian Attorney General George Brandis, who, as you'll see in this video we're about to show, looks, in my opinion, creepily like a Dick Cheney. So he's been appearing on the morning talk shows over the last few weeks to further promote and explain exactly what the government is or isn't going to be doing with your metadata. So let's hear his expert analysis, shall we?
The Minister said today it's not what you're doing on the internet, it's the sites you're visiting. So will it be the sites that you're visiting?
Well, it wouldn't extend to, for example, web surfing. So what people are viewing on the internet is not going to be caught.
So it's not the sites you're visiting?
Well, what people are viewing on the internet when they web surf is not going to be caught. What will be caught is the web address they communicate to.
Okay, so it's only, the web address, if I go to an internet site, that will be recorded and available.
The web address is part of the metadata.
The website?
The web address. The electronic address of the website.
Okay, but if I go to the Sky News website, the Australian website, a more questionable website, that will be, is that what we're talking about here?
Well, what you're viewing on the internet is not what we're interested in, and that's not what we regard.
But you'll be able to see whether I've been to that website or that website or that website.
Well, what we'll be able, what the security agencies want to know to be retained, is the electronic address of the website. When a connection is made between a one computer terminal and a web address, that fact and the time of the connection and the duration of the connection is what we mean by metadata in that context.
but that is telling you where I've been on the web.
So yeah, as you can see, not really much more to say about that. So however, in some other related news, James, with the G20 in Brisbane getting ever closer, more concerns are being raised that Brisbane residents are still unaware at the true scope of the G20 policing powers. And also just finally, a great article from echo.net asked the questions, what will happen when Australian police have military weapons? I don't know, maybe some of the folks in Ferguson, Missouri would have something to say about that.
So wait, Brock, you'll have the web address, but will that be the sites that I visit? Will you? I'm getting so confused. Oh, it's funny to watch 60-year-olds trying to regulate something that they don't understand, a phenomenon that we've seen playing out in many countries around the world, sadly no different in Australia, and I guess it would be funny if it wasn't, again, so serious, and unfortunately it is serious, because obviously, once again, as you say, the terranoia, the hysteria is being ramped up to absolute maximum once again. Conveniently coming along just as this anti-terror legislation is trying to be ramrodded through in the Australian Parliament, as it is in other countries besides. So it is a convenient little excuse for them to once again remind us exactly why we're living in this new post-9/11 world. And it always seems to come up around the time of the 9/11 anniversary, doesn't it? Well, interesting developments there, and of course this all does relate back to that that phenomenon that you mentioned there at the end, briefly, the militarization of Australian police, because of course, as people should know by now, the G20 is coming to your neck of the woods in the very near future. Tell us a little bit what the not the preparations, but sort of what the feeling on the ground is there. Are people getting prepared for this? Is it affecting people's lives in any way yet? Are people talking about it?
Not as yet. I mean, people seem to be quite blasé about it still. No one's really kind of talking about it. The only mention of it is to do with, you know, further policing powers, and also the main talking point recently is about whether Vladimir Putin is going to be allowed to attend the G20, which I think is neither here or there. It's more geopolitical posturing than anything else. But nothing's still really, and I think that's the point I'm trying to get across here, is that there is going to be quite a shock. Like a lot of Australians that I came into contact with, they were quite openly shocked about the militarization of the police in the Ferguson issue. They were like, oh my God, what's happened to the police in America? They're completely militarized. They're acting like the armies in Iraq. And I, you know, of course, it's like, yeah, that's a few years old. That's old news now. So hopefully we're not going to have the same kind of shock and awe, pardon the pun, here when the G20 rolls around just up the road.
Right. Well, sadly, unfortunately, I think that shock is something that they rely on once again to help boost this type of anti-terror legislation and other types of repressive legislation and policies. So I think they are going to try to provoke something. I think we have to be very wary of that. And that's obviously coming up not too long from now, as I say, right in your neck of the woods. So we'll definitely be following that. What else have we got up on the plate today?
In our second segment, James, we'll move our attention to another important flashpoint of the Asia-Pacific region, that, of course, being the South China Sea. And since we last spoke, the metaphorical powder keg that is the South China Sea continues to be packed ever more tightly. Well, firstly, James, we'll take our first story from NHK with the headline reading, China adding military facilities on Spratly Islands. Quote, the Philippine military says China is adding weapons and other equipment to its facilities built on reefs in the disputed Spratly Islands in the South China Sea. Aerial photos taken by the Philippine military show that China is beefing up its existing facilities while building new installations elsewhere. NHK has obtained newly taken photos of the reefs under China's effective control. These islands are claimed by China, the Philippines, and also other countries. The photos of the mischief reef taken in April show solar panels, radar facilities, and what looked like to be machine guns. Over on the Subi Reef, however, a white spherical object believed to be a large radar facility can be easily seen. Moving on, James, secondly, US spy plane may have triggered the recent Chinese jet interception. This coming from scmp.com, the South China Morning Post. A Chinese fighter jet's interception of a US Navy sub-Hunter aircraft was possibly triggered when the American plane dropped a sonar surveillance system into the South China Sea. A Chinese J-11 fighter jet reportedly flew within metres of the US Navy P-8 Poseidon when it performed acrobatic manoeuvres a roundup over international waters east of Hainan Island last week, triggering a war of words between the two nations. US officials have called the act aggressive and dangerous, but China denied its pilot did anything wrong and said the maneuver was a response to large-scale and highly frequent close-in reconnaissance by US aircraft. And finally, James, for a third and final story in this segment, we'll put this one in the that's kind of weird file. The Philippines military to offer cruise services in the South China Sea, this one coming via The Diplomat. Quote, the Philippines military wants to create a cruise service to give tourists an up-close and personal view of disputed parts of the South China Sea. The newly installed Chief of Staff of the Armed Forces of the Philippines outlined his vision for a cruise service on Thursday, this is a few Thursdays ago, while visiting the Palawan-based Western Command, which is responsible for monitoring the South China Sea. The Philippines military entering into a public-slash-private partnership for a cruise service around these disputed islands is likely to be fiercely opposed by China. More importantly, China maintains patrol ships in the region that regularly harass Philippine fishermen. Thus, a cruise service in the regional flashpoint could potentially jeopardize the safety of all the people on board. So, James, yeah, a lot to be said about all of those developments. Anyone in particular you want to pick up on, but before you do, can I interest you in a luxurious military cruise to a potentially volatile geopolitical flashpoint?
Sure. And when it gets commandeered by the People's Liberation Navy, I guess it can become a literal slowboat to China. No thanks. I'll pass on that one. But it's interesting because obviously what's happening here is we have both sides in the Spratly Island dispute trying to make a physical on the ground, on the water reality in terms of positioning assets and deploying things there in the region to try to make it sort of, you know, so that they have something physical to back up their claims. But, you know, the Chinese are deploying military assets. The Philippines Filipinos are trying to deploy a cruise ship. I don't know. I don't think that's going to win in that particular case. But at any rate, it does show that there's an escalation to what's going on here, as we've already seen. And I think the escalation is now taking the dangerous precedent of being in that form of you deploy something physical in that water, in that area, and then you claim it as your own and dare someone to come and get you. That seems to be the way this is going, and I don't want to see that type of brinksmanship, obviously, because that the only path that leads is towards confrontation. It's just a question of how long it takes to get there. So, what else can we say? We've said it every single episode of this broadcast, but it really is just a powder keg, and it really is a point of contention. And again, I don't think any side is looking for military confrontation right now, but all of these things add up to that, and all it takes is one hothead firing the wrong shot on the wrong day in the wrong way to start something much bigger than what they wanted. So I don't like to see this, but I don't see any signs of it backing down or backing away from the table at this point.
Exactly right. Just like I said in the second story there, the U.S. spy plane and the China jet having a close interception. It's those type of events that are real, are happening. And, you know, as you said, no one wants a hot war in the Asia Pacific yet, but it only takes the wrong Yahoo to set off a series of events that unfortunately will just snowball into a greater conflict. So, James, let's move to our third and final segment, and something we haven't covered a lot in the last few episodes of Asia Pacific Perspective, but something that I'm constantly working on, and I know you are constantly keeping your eye on and working on as well, that is, of course, what's going on, continuing to go on at Fukushima Daiichi. So, James, we'll take our first story, headline reading, Japanese government to disclose Fukushima chief's testimony, finally. The government plans to make public testimony regarding the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster given by plant chief Masao Yoshida, possibly shedding light on whether Yoshida ordered staff to remain at their posts. The testimony of Yoshida, who died in July 2013, was compiled by a government panel formed to examine the March 2011 disaster at the plant. The government has thus far declined to make public Yoshida's testimony, citing a statement Yoshida signed saying he did not want it made available to any third party. But interest in Yoshida's first-hand account of what really happened in the days immediately after the disaster, when a massive earthquake and tsunami knocked out power to much of the 6-reactor Fukushima plant, leading to a series of explosions and the worst disaster since Chernobyl, had been piqued by reporters that most of the staff actually fled the scene. Secondly, James, moving on to our next headline, TEPCO found liable for evacuee suicide. A Japanese court has ruled that TEPCO was responsible for a woman's suicide after the March 2011 disaster and must pay compensation, in a landmark ruling that could set a precedent for other claims against the utility. The civil suit by Mikio Watanabe claimed that TEPCO was to blame for the July 2011 death of his wife, Hamako, who doused herself in kerosene and set herself on fire after falling into depression. The district court in Fukushima ruled in favour of Watanabe, with TEPCO ordered to pay roughly about $472,000 in compensation. The court's decision is the latest blow for the utility, which was bailed out with taxpayer funds in 2012 and expects to spend more than $48 billion in compensation alone for the nuclear disaster. And finally, James, over the last 3 years, with no real answers forthcoming as to what to do about the other reactors, as being reactors 1, 2, and 3, all of which suffered critical core meltdowns in the immediate aftermath of the tsunami, I don't know, maybe this is a tiny baby step forward towards figuring out a solution, and this one coming from NHK. Looking inside Fukushima Daiichi with Muon tomography. Quote, workers have begun the difficult task of decommissioning the Fukushima Daiichi plant. One of the biggest hurdles they face, however, is how to remove melted fuel from the crippled reactors. First, they need to know the conditions of the fuel. Experts believe it has cooled down and turned into debris, but engineers with TEPCO have not been able to check the actual state of the debris due to the high levels of radiation. Now they might have figured out a way to measure the highly toxic materials. Elementary particles called muons rain down from space. Every 10 minutes, 10,000 muons per square meter reach Earth. Scientists rely on this particle to probe materials that are beyond our reach. One example is volcanic magma. The technique is called muon imaging or muon tomography. When these particles hit a high-density object, such as magma, they lose energy or are absorbed. By measuring these changes, scientists can determine the shape of the magma in a way that kind of resembles an X-ray. However, now researchers are hoping to use this technique to gain a better understanding of the situation inside the damaged reactors at Fukushima. By using muons, we expect to be able to look after the presence. We expect to be able to look for the presence of heavy materials, even if radiation levels are so high that we cannot approach the area. One of the studies being conducted by scientists from Toshiba and the US Los Alamos National Laboratory, their plan is to place detectors on opposite sides of each reactor. The detectors will be used to track the behavior of muons as they pass through the concrete walls and the shielding of the reactor in a bid to determine the status of the molten fuel. James, your thoughts on any of these? It seems that every other week TEPCO has created itself a deeper and deeper quagmire.
Well, that muon story is extremely interesting to me because that goes to, if you'll excuse the pun, the core of the problem at Fukushima, which, I mean, we talk about the 300, 400 tons of radioactive water that's leaking out into the ocean every day, and we talk about the ice wall and the groundwater diversions and everything they're trying to do, the leaking containment for the radioactive water, but all of that is just symptoms of the problem at Fukushima, which is the molten reactor cores, which are lying in some way. They don't know how, they don't know where, they assume they're at the bottom of the containment, they don't know where they are, they don't know how they're lying, they don't have the technology to even begin approaching those reactor vessels, let alone begin thinking about how to actually encase or in any way move those cores so that they can actually decommission the site. I mean, that is the core of the problem, and that is that again, they do not even have the technology to begin approaching that that problem at this point. So now they're, I mean, you say a baby step. This is even less than a baby step. It's maybe a wiggle slightly forward, in which they may, through this system, which again they haven't tested and they don't know if they'll be able to do it, but they may be able to use this muon tomography to perhaps be able to get some sort of X-ray like picture of where the cores are lying, so they can at least begin to start to think about how they might develop a plan for maybe in the future, perhaps in some way approaching the cores. Again, I mean, that is the heart of the problem, and all of the other symptoms of that problem are kind of just window dressing on that. So until they even begin to approach that, they'll never begin to approach the actual real decommissioning of the site. So that's, I mean, that at least puts in perspective just how far away we are from actually solving anything that's fundamentally happening there. And then the other stories, I mean, again, everything surrounding this is just so crazy as well, including the fact that now TEPCO has been held liable for the suicide of an evacuee. That's pretty major. Because again, that opens up an entire legal floodgate for TEPCO and other people who have been affected by that, that could significantly add to the compensation they're already planning, which is already approaching $50 billion that they're planning overall in terms of compensation. This could add much more to that potentially. So again, the economic costs, all of the different costs on this just continue adding up, and it's the environmental costs, obviously. It's just an ongoing nightmare. I mean, it's just insane what's happening there. And unfortunately, again, as we've noted many times, you won't find any of this unless you're actually looking for these stories, because they've just completely slipped off the radar.
Yeah, a lot of these stories are really confined to the Asia Pacific region, be it Japan Times, NHK, and you know, some of the other sources that we try and use quite a bit, you know, Informable and exxkf.blogspot.com are really great resources. But there's not, as you said, there's less than a handful of people who are still keeping their eye on this. So, as always, hopefully people will keep up to date with FukushimaUpdate.com. James, just quickly as we finish up, just in some other related nuclear news, sold to run out of storage for spent nuclear fuel by 2016, which is an interesting one, and just posted today on my site, apperspective.net, Australia's radioactive racism, which goes in great detail to explain the plans by the Australian government to dump nuclear waste on Aboriginal lands in the Northern Territory. An interesting read nonetheless, which it really shines a light on the appalling attitude that Australian politicians have towards the history, welfare and concerns of our Indigenous people.
Unfortunately, no surprise there. But yes, a pretty sickening story nonetheless. All right, well, a very somber note to end things on. I wish we had some wonderful, happy story to end things on. We'll have to work on that for next time, maybe. But next time, again, maybe a little while, because between now and next time, you're going to be coming out to Japan. So we'll actually be meeting in person once again and hopefully putting out some media in the meantime. But until then, until you get back to Australia, we probably won't be doing another AP Perspective. So people just have to hold on to their hats. But while they're doing that, obviously, stay tuned to apperspective.net, still being maintained and updated on a regular basis with all these types of stories. You're doing an admirable job there. And, of course, doing the yeoman's work of keeping Fukushima Update posted with new material all the time as well. So my hat's off to you once again for all the work you're doing, Brock. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, James. I will see you in a few weeks, mate. Looking forward to it.
Looking forward to it here.